Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone. How good was that? Comfortably the best weekend of the Six Nations so far, I think you'll agree. We had upset wins for Italy and England, followed by Wales and France throwing haymakers at each other in Cardiff until Les Bleus pulled clear. A great weekend. We'll now do our best to recap everything in this episode while also hearing from Lewis Rees-Zammit and about his progress towards his dream of playing in the NFL. I'm Ben Coles and I'm here in the studio with Charlie Morgan.
Cozy, cozy.
And also by Charles. Wait, Charles, you're not sitting opposite me. Where are you?
No, I am in Wales because I was at the Principality yesterday for those haymakers.
And how were they? It looked fun.
It was fun. I wasn't actually that impressed by France. I'm sure we'll come on to that, but it was very fun. They pulled clear because they just had too much ballast. But it was a good game of rugby. I thought for a second we might have the third upset of the weekend.
Charlie, not to pull back the curtain too much, but we were just chatting before this about how it almost felt like it needed a weekend like this. Well, it probably needed one upset. Set and then to have two on the same day, hours apart, that's great, isn't it?
Yeah, we got what we deserve for being righteous all tournament and saying that what this tournament needs is this, and it needs Ireland's procession to a Grand Slam to be stopped somehow, and who's going to do it? But Italy beating Scotland in a thriller, and then another upset to follow. We were spoiled, weren't we?
We certainly were. Let's talk favourite moments. Let's talk highlights. Charles, if I come to you, what leapt out for you?
Nolan Le Garrick's pass.
Oh, yeah.
Emmanuel Faye-Wabosso's run down the touchline in the last few moments of England's victory over Ireland.
Well, don't hog all of them.
No, and then Italy in general. Superb.
He's nicked all the answers. Sorry, Charlie.
Yeah, he has. That middle one he's got inside knowledge as well, because he was next to me and I let out an involuntary noise, which was... I thought it was honestly going to end with England being sort of meekly pushed out into touch when they on that final play. But amazing kind of conviction for Faye-Wabosso to back himself after seeing the space and communicating that in. And we got him in the mix zone afterwards. The quotes will be online on our website later this afternoon. But the way he spoke about it was, yep, saw the space, asked for the ball. It was Bundyaki opposite me, so I sort of backed myself to get around him. I just thought, wow, this guy's cut from a different cloth. Sort of.
I think how it went was Kerr passed the ball to Faye-Wabosso and Charlie shouted, no. And then on a delay, I went, yes.
I said, you've got to go back in field. But no, he's actually all right.
In Charlie's defence, he's done so much analysis on England's not good attack that I can see why his instant reaction was to think that he was watching a repeat of some other blown opportunity. So that's okay. I'll have to go with Rome. It's my first time at the Stadio Olimpico, and they won for the first time in, what, 11 years? So that hopefully they'll be flying me back for many trips in the future.
Have you got one moment, or it was the whole last sort of...
I did love the noise at the final whistle was great. Best hype man, maybe, in the Six Nations, because he doesn't stop, does he, the guy on the microphone at the Olimpico? We're trying to rev them up. Like he's constantly...
He's got Michele Lamaro's engine.
Constantly on it. If I had to pick a favourite moment, we'll talk more about the game in a bit. It was maybe when George Horn's try was disallowed, you then had Garbisi like trying to rev up the crowd and like basically celebrating as if they'd won the game. And I was like, oh, that's weird. I think essentially everything good or bad Italy do kind of runs through him and how well he's playing. And he was red hot. He was so good. So yeah, what a pleasure. What a pleasure to be there. As I said earlier, we're going to hear from Lewis Rees-Sammet later on. So he's kind of building towards his pro day in the NFL on March 20th, where basically he's going to be impressing scouts, hopefully, in some drills. I think it's in South Florida, just trying to kind of, you know, get on their radar ahead of the NFL draft. It's quite interesting. He was very complimentary about Cam Winnett for Wales, as we have been too. And yeah, I think it's fascinating. I mean, Charlie, you're quite a big NFL watcher like me. The standard is just so high that he really seems to have parked this kind of idea that he's a rugby player because he has to, because he knows the challenge ahead and he has to have that mindset to deliver, really.
Yeah, I love that. That's what George Skivington, his ex-Gloucester head coach, said, wasn't it? He said, if you want to know anything about his mindset, he's decided that his last game of rugby has been and gone and he's now an NFL player. And I think, you know, we talk about he's a freakish athlete, you would say, by the standards of rugby union, but in the NFL, it's a totally different story, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I had a bit of time with Lewis Leiner as well in the mix zone after the Italy game, so we'll hear about his impressive try-scoring debut. But let's get stuck in first to one of England's best results for years, certainly their best performance, probably since that 2019 semi-final. Let's have a chat about it. Okay, given both of you were at Twickenham, I'll defer to you both slightly for insight on this. But Charles, it sounds like the atmosphere at Twickenham, it was the best it's been for donkey's years, that it was on a new level. Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was just, and that's what comes from beating one of the best teams in the world. You know, the stadium was absolutely jumping. I was there till quite late because I met up with a couple of mates, and even until the players had left, there were still fans sort of lost in the revelry of a wonderful win. And it was as noisy when the drop goal went over. That was as noisy as it's been in a while. It seems to always happen against Ireland, actually, because in that game in 2022, when Charlie Ewers was sent off, I think that was a sort of, in terms of atmosphere, that was quite a defining day as well for Twickenham, in that's as noisy as I've heard it in a long while. And that was certainly the case on Saturday, and long may it continue.
Hang on, I want to hear more about how long you were holding on, hanging around at Twickenham for. Just, you know, were you there until they turned off the lights? Like, how late were you there?
Not quite until they turned off the lights, but until I watched the Irish team bus leave.
Okay.
Just tops off in the Guinness tent.
What, Charles?
Yeah. Charles was, yeah.
Oh, fine.
Yeah.
Charlie, listen, I think we have said repeatedly on here and in writing, so it's on record, that we were waiting to see something like this from England on Saturday. Can you just sort of sum up how pleased you were actually to see them play like they did, but also how big this is for this side in terms of a step forward and getting everybody on board?
I thought I'll answer the first bit first. I think it's huge for the team itself, just because they'd have been working towards a plan. I think they would have really seen the phrase Borthwick used, I'm paraphrasing slightly, was just, it was important for them to get validation for their hard work. And I think validation for the plans they put in place, how they targeted Ireland, clearly with a big focus on kick return. They needed, we said last week, I feel like we did anyway, that they couldn't just go there and spoil. And England's players said that. He said, we're not just there to spoil set piece and kick loads and impart a pressure game plan. They knew they needed a little bit more. And we said, didn't we, they needed to be sort of slicker in transition. I think we said it, and I wasn't entirely confident that they could be that slick. You know, the two tries that they scored before Ben Earls through Ollie Lawrence and then Furbank directly from kick return, and they generated quick rucks with the first carry, or quick enough rucks to just almost catch Ireland over committing to the tackle area, and then just getting their spacing wrong, both on the first time on the short side and then the second time on the open side. And then they punished them really clinically. Now, you do not, you tend to find yourself saying that about other sides. You find yourself saying that about New Zealand a lot, that they'll pick off an overlap quite easily and punish a side for becoming too narrow. We said it about Scotland against England. We say it about Ireland all the time. That you're able to say that about England, I think, would have made it very satisfying for supporters, and actually very satisfying having covered the team and sort of seeing kind of hints of what they're trying to do. Felix Jones said, we want an 80-minute performance. Whether or not it was that, that's the sort of holy grail, isn't it? But that you just saw a conviction to go with what they would have talked about in the week.
Yeah, there's something really satisfying about it, isn't it? Because you can sort of, you feel personally able to buy in a lot more into what they're trying to do when you can actually see proof of it. I thought the reactions afterwards were really interesting, because you had Ben Earl was pretty defiant, sort of talking about the negativity that had come England's way, and saying that people have been calling them the worst England ever. We're still trying to find out who actually gave that quote. But listen, I think we're all of an opinion that if that's what is needed to kind of rev England up and to get that kind of performance out of Earl, great.
Earl was phenomenal. I think he was helped by how that pack was rebalanced a bit. No slight on Ethan Roots, but what we saw from England, with they had Slade and Lawrence, that second game, a bit more cohesion. They had Itoje Martin and Chessum. Those are two things I think that they wanted from the start of the Six Nations. And obviously Mitchell being back fit. How's his engine? My goodness. Mm. That game grew ragged from how sort of high there were quite a few, because of the kicking changes, there were quite a few long passages, and long passages where England were in possession, and he must have covered so much ground. So well done to his elastic ACLs in his knees. He's done very well there. But no, Ben Earl is a guy who I think, having spoken to him a fair bit in interviews and things, I feel fairly confident saying that he maybe needs to manufacture those chips on his shoulder sometimes to get a performance out of himself and to rev himself up before the World Cup quarterfinal, where he was fantastic. He said, I don't feel like I've delivered on the highest stage yet. And then he sort of almost needs to put pressure on himself. I know in age group rugby, he sort of would look at someone like Tom Curry and really want to kind of emulate him and sort of put pressure on himself to emulate him. And whatever he did worked for him.
Charles, can I ask you about, we were quite excited for George Martin to be back and trying to guess really how they would do with Itoje Martin Chessum. Would it be Itoje at six? Would it be Martin at six? In the end, it ended up being Chessum. Martin's return was fantastic. Why was he so effective and so important for England, did you think, against Ireland?
He just set the tone physically. He was running around belting people. There was one great moment in the first half where he, I think it was under a penalty advantage, where he completely cut Tadhg Byrne in two and sort of stood over him like a heavyweight boxer. He just knocked out his adversary. It really set the physical tone, and I think he really sort of disrupted Ireland, as did Ollie Chessum. You know, the two of them were running around, that Leicester have started dubbing them the Bash Brothers, and that there was a couple of times where Chessum put in some big shots. You think of that where he sort of slightly injured himself, knocking Aki into touch on the restart. This was a new sort of side to England that we hadn't seen too much, mainly because Martin and Chessum have not played together too often, but that sort of physicality and that brutality was a great foil to Itoje, who we saw some lovely skillful touches from him, and all of a sudden it looked quite balanced, the English back.
The disruption point is really interesting, because we saw Wales 2 weeks ago kind of be quite passive in defence and not flood the breakdown, and Ireland therefore struggled because there were bodies, like more bodies in the defensive line. And while they could recycle, they couldn't find the space they wanted. This was almost the opposite approach, where it was, we're just going to brutalise your breakdown and you will not get any clean right ball, and therefore can't have your fancy pods out the back because you need to flood in to actually keep possession, which was such an effective approach from England.
Yeah, it seems like in the build-up, we were sort of told that there were, or it became apparent that there were two ways England could go about it. The Wales approach you're describing there, Colsey, seems fairly similar to what New Zealand did against them in the quarterfinal, whereby they sort of held off a little bit and funneled them towards touchlines and then went hard at the breakdown of touchlines. Guys like, I think Lester Fainganuku played in that game, and he's a bit of a handful. Ardie Surveyor was a handful out wide as well. England would have taken, I think, a lot of heart from how they went in the last two Six Nations games against Ireland, where they didn't necessarily have this overt blitz approach, which is what Felix Jones has so explicitly brought in, but they've forced a lot of turnovers through proactive line speed, through targeting receivers in as part of Ireland's phase play, and it was just really interesting. Obviously, England still conceded two tries, and they were in transition, weren't they, a little bit.
Lovely finish from James Lowe for his second, actually.
Two really well worked tries, and that's another reason England can be pleased with how they went, because although Ireland were disrupted and the 6-2 bench going wrong or just going wrong out of kind of misfortune with Nash and Frawley's injuries, Ireland still got very, very close to winning that game because they are a champion side. So for England to sort of weather the storm, I think you always talk about in the Eddie Jones era, we saw a lot of fast starts, didn't we? And then maybe that momentum had petered out and then players were sort of left going, right, okay, do we stick at plan A or whatever? There was a real strength and conviction throughout the game for England, that they knew they had to be good at kick return, that they knew they had to disrupt Ireland's set piece. I agree with Charles. Martin was massive in the maul. That, they took away that a little bit from Ireland. And they kept at it and they got their reward at the end.
The fast start point is quite interesting because I messaged both of you when I was mopping up everything in Rome and said it sounds like they've come out of the blocks.
What happened in Rome?
Absolutely firing. Later. And I sort of texted you both saying it sounds like England are absolutely flying out of the blocks here, but they might be losing a bit of steam. And you both like, well...
Not really.
Well, Charles was like,
no, I agreed.
Really.
I agreed because Ireland did some mind games 101, bit of kidology at halftime when Crowley kicked the penalty to go 12-8 up. Everybody sprinted off, all the Ireland players sprinted off the field. And I can't remember who I saw. It was a forward. It wasn't Dan Carles. He was on. Sorry. I'm not gonna pick
that's,
on Dan Carles. But
worse.
There was a player who went not quite down to their haunches, but definitely hands on thighs. I thought, well, were England flying here? Because psychologically, they'd played well and were yet down 4 points and against a good side, and they would go down further as by 17-8. But no, they stuck at it after half time.
I'd highly recommend Charlie's analysis, obviously, post match from yesterday, about one particular point in the build up to the George Furbank try where Ireland was so kind of thrown out of shape by England that you had five people on one side of the field just opposite Ben Earl. And I know Ben Earl played very well, but I mean that I think everyone would agree that's over resourcing one side of your defensive line.
Do you remember how much we went to town at England's defense for Tommy Allen's try in Rome? It reminded me a lot of that, where it's just speed can really kind of really throw off defensive structure, and that's what England did, and what we haven't seen them do for a while.
I know, Charles. Let's talk about the ending, and particularly. Manny Faye-Wabosa has just made a fantastic impact on this team in the last two games. Speaking to people through a piece kind of in the build-up about his incredible rise. I mean, it really is a year since he was playing for Taunton in National 1, and look at him go. The vibe was very much, I just hope they can sort of give him the ball and time and space to be him and to show how effective he can be. I would say that they did that at the end. Would you agree, Charles?
Yeah, I would. I think he's touching world class, to be honest. Whoa. Already, he looks absolutely superb. He looks, when he came off the bench at Murrayfield, he looked like he was sort of playing a different sport. He just covers the ground so quickly. He's so strong. He's so lean. He's built like a brick outhouse. And his start was completely justified. And he looked as good as any of the wings on the pitch.
And in terms of the actual finish itself, a cracking moment for Marcus Smith with the drop goal. I saw some interesting points, and we might have actually had these in our questions this week. Thank you for sending them in. We'll get to them. People just querying Charlie whether, because England had that penalty advantage so close to the post. I mean, I feel like this is a bit like looking a gift horse in the mouth. Like if the drop goal was there to win a game against Ireland, you take the game against Ireland. I don't know. Should they have risked something to try and get the bonus point try, given the penalty advantage was being played? I don't know.
Maybe I'm a coward. Maybe I'm technically inept. But I think I'd have given myself two chances by taking the drop goal and then also with that penalty in the back pocket.
It's true.
What do you think?
No, it's true. Because it's easy. It's so easy for everyone who isn't Marcus Smith to sit here and say, oh, that penalty's a gimme from however far out. Like, you know.
That point does change the dynamic a little bit, as far as if England do get it, they're within three of Ireland going into going into the final weekend, and therefore it's any sort of win for Scotland that gives them a bigger chance of it. But
I think they deserved it. I think that was more the thing. I don't think it's going to make any difference to the table, because I think surely Ireland are going to beat Scotland in Dublin. But I think they deserved it. I think they were significantly better than Ireland on the day, and I think they deserved that bonus point win.
Yeah,
I think it was more of a mentality thing if they had gone for it, and that just to get that four try, just to say that we've beaten one of, if not the best team in the world, with a bonus point.
I think Joe Marler was desperate for the ball, wasn't he? Based on one tweet that I saw, where he was basically having a go at his Quinn's colleagues for not supplying him with a short range carry right before the drop goal.
I mean, to his point, he was part of a bench that the front row were brought on with 25 minutes at least to go, including Theo Dan. That was really, but I thought that was a proactive, really impressive part of how Steve Borthwick managed it. And Joe Marler's kind of alive there. He's calling for the ball for Danny Kerr to just tighten up that ruck defence. So serious point is, you know, he's a pretty switched on rugby player, Joe Marler.
He hasn't got a try in however many tests, does he? So I think that's really the main gripe. We talk about Ireland. You've mentioned the disruption, obviously. I mean, that's the issue with the 6-2, sometimes it can backfire and you will have to play a scrum half on the wing. But they just couldn't get going, could they, because of the work that England did. They didn't look slick. They never looked comfortable. And I think Peter Imani kind of said that they just, England just disrupted them to a point where they were kind of limited in their approach. You still had, you know, Bundyaki pouncing for the odd turnover and flashes of control, but they weren't quite themselves. And is that actually, that's a huge compliment to England, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I mean, as Charlie said, it's testament to their class that they were still realistically in with a shot of winning that game until the final play, despite the fact that they were almost to a man outplayed by England on the day. But they'll be back. They'll be back. I think they'll beat Scotland. I think they'll beat Scotland next week. They'll be Six Nations champions again. Okay, the two successive Grand Slams have evaded them. The 6-2 split, when that happens, it looks foolish. I wrote that in the player ratings, that it looked foolish. And ultimately, you could say it's cost them the game, really, because the forward cavalry that came on didn't do enough to mitigate for the issues in the back line. Jameson Gibson-Park, I thought England could have exploited him on the wing more. But even then, he was coming off his wing and playing beautifully on the wing. He put in the scoring pass for Lowe, didn't he? And for that, was it Lowe's second try? A beautiful quick hand. And yeah, I mean, they obviously managed it well, given the circumstances, with Jameson Gibson-Park out on the wing, but he shouldn't never have had to have been there in the first place, I don't think.
Where do we sit, just to wrap up this section, how do we kind of feel about the final decision by Colin Murray to kick to touch with about 90 seconds left, I think it was? Would you, it's an interesting debate, isn't it? Do you try and push England back into their own half and make them attack from deep? I mean, obviously that worked out for England because of Faye Wiboso, or do you go through the phases in your own 22 and just try and wind down the clock? Personally, doing the going face to face, ruck to ruck in your own 22 or around there really gives me the jitters, just because there's so many breakdown offences that can happen.
Yeah.
And your forwards are knackered. Like, you could easily go off your feet, or you could seal off, or you could come in the side.
And you've been harried by England for the whole game in your own half. So England, just a tiny, to touch on their defensive strategy really, really quickly. One element of it from restarts was to be kick long to Aki, Ireland's best carrier, have Chesserman, Faye Wiboso go after him. And then off the next phase, when they're playing back in field, you had Underhill and Itoje really putting pressure on that. And then England aimed to put a lot of pressure on James Lowe's clearance. That's just a sort of a snapshot of the pressure they were trying to put Ireland under in their own half. Now, I'm just looking at now, it's about 90 seconds left when Murray clears. I think you're doing that all the time. I think you do it from the edge of your own 22. I think that's just the decision. That's the decision 90 times out of 100. And you're backing, and because you're doing that, you're saying, well, we'll back our defence against England attack rather than our ability to keep the ball against a defence that's been harrying us. I just think that was... They gave England one more chance to attack them with 14 men after Chandler Cunningham South was off. It's not a bad decision.
Is perhaps the issue that it was a kick to touch, maybe? Might they have been better off kind of kicking infield, perhaps, kind of centrally, and then coming up as a defensive line?
Maybe in hindsight, that's something they'd think about, yeah.
Only because by England having a line out is sort of a chance for England to rest, kind of get an idea of what they want to do and just get an extra bit in the legs. I mean, if I'm quibbling, maybe that's the thing. But like I said, yeah, if they'd been going ruck to ruck, that would have made me very jittery because so much could go wrong.
And England counterattacks really well. So there's nothing to say that them keeping the ball in field would have ended any differently. I think Charlie's right. I think they had to back their D. I mean, getting the ball, you know, it was unlikely. If as a bookmaker, you would have been giving it short odds on England scoring a try from that line out. But it would have been much more likely to concede a penalty. Running down the clock for 90 seconds always ends in tears.
Which just makes what England did all the more impressive, given they managed to manufacture a goal to win. A great day for England. Ireland will be back. Let's have a chat about the other games in the Six Nations this weekend.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, over to Rome and the earlier upset of the day, where Italy, after 10 years and 51 weeks, I made it exactly, finally won in Rome again in the Six Nations. And they were well worth it, actually, because Scotland did a Scotland. And they can only seem to perform at an exceptionally high level for patches in this tournament and then mentally drop off and sort of implode into themselves. And that paved the way for a great win.
From your perspective, where were they flattest? Or where did they give Italy the most kind of ins into the game?
It's dumb penalties. It's dumb penalties, just like it was. So in Cardiff, you remember there was that ludicrous penalty count at the end. What was it, like 4-14 penalties or something?
The amount in a row, yeah.
Yeah, where Scotland were kind of blown off the park. And Gregor Townsend after that game was actually sort of like, look, this is weird. Like, this is an anomaly. That doesn't normally happen. And then in the France game, they then had a ridiculously low number of penalties. I think it was like 6 or something. Here in Italy, they when that George Horn try was disallowed just after half time, it would have been a conversion under the sticks. So Scotland would have just gone; they would have gone 13 points up, and you kind of thought that might be the end of the start of the end of the contest if Scotland can just keep their nerve. But they're just giving away too many dumb penalties, like at the ruck in terms of sealing off or kind of going in for turnovers when they're not there. I think there's a real question about their mentality. I think it's been the theme of the whole championship is Scotland are constantly being tested about, have you got the nerve to hold this? They did against England because they went 10-0 down, didn't they, in the opening minutes, a game where they were big favourites. I think everybody thought, well, here we go again, Scotland are going to blow their big chance. And actually, partly because England produced an absurd number of handling errors, Scotland came back and won that game. But they just, they collapsed here. It was, well, that does a disservice to Italy. Scotland collapsed having started incredibly impressively. They actually looked like they were going to run away with it. I thought what Italy did in terms of their creativity, in terms of resetting at halftime, there's a lot of flair in this Italian side, but they're quite pragmatic in the way that their kicking game works.
I was going to say that what impressed me was the blend of it. Yeah. They've got a really nice kind of balance about when, and just talking about how they're playing in their own half, whether they go, right, no, this defense looks solid, we're going to go long with a kicking game, or they go, let's have a look out wide, and then we can always fall back on that kicking game. It's a really, really nice blend. Whereas before under Crowley, you'd probably say that they were just all out hitting width all the time, and that gave sides opportunities to squeeze them. I think you can really see how the kind of blend that Gonzalo Quesada has kind of implemented there, and it's exciting.
And what a missed opportunity for Scotland, given what happened at Twickenham afterwards. You know, if they'd have just held on for that win in Rome, they'd have been going to Dublin for a tournament decider.
I know. I think what I like about Italy is that there's quite a strong mentality here for quite a young group. So that you're talking about young guys here, like most of them in their early 20s and not a lot of caps, but they didn't, when Scotland were pretty much scoring off most of their attacks in the first half, Italy didn't crumble. They kept in the fight. But Garbisi missed one sitter of a kick, but actually his control was just brilliant. And just to tee up kind of how Italy came back into the game and took the lead, I've got a bit of audio chatting to Lewis Lynher after the game. I mean, we need to chat about him as well, but here's what he had to make of his very, very promising first start for Italy.
And it's an amazing atmosphere. The only thing I've come close to is the Stade de France when I went with England, travelling reserve at the end of the Six Nations a few years ago. That atmosphere is very similar to that, and I'd love it just to keep being like that, no matter win or lose. Full house every time we play would be, but it's a big ask, but it made a huge difference. I can tell you that from all the boys being in there.
What was the last message from your dad this morning in terms of advice of how to handle the moment?
He said 9's his lucky number, and today's the 9th of March, so I kind of good omen again. But no, he said just go out there and just trust yourself, and obviously a few tactical things in there, but it's just be yourself and trust the people around you. And like I said in other interviews, that all the guys, since I've come into the team, have been amazing and helped me in any way I can, whether it's with moves or what to do. And I tried to also maybe offer some advice as well, but I think we really clicked today. Again, it wasn't perfect and we got some things to work on going into Wales, but definitely a high right now.
I was going to say, how often have you and Paolo had a chance to work on like running onto those grubbers, because it worked perfectly there?
Yeah,
to create.
I've been trying to work on that, just seeing where the space is. And yeah, we've got a really good system implemented by the coaches, but also rugby's rugby. If the space is there, we're going to take it. And I think we're really adapting to that well, and we've got an amazing talented group of players, and it just shows that when we can put it together, all the hard work, and when we're up for it emotionally, it's all there. Saying that, it doesn't need to be necessarily a perfect storm for Italy to win. I feel like the group going forward, there's something amazing coming in, and I think we can hopefully go into Wales, heads held high, and go for another win. But I think we're building something really special here.
And just for you personally, there's been so much attention on leaving Quinns and choosing to play for Italy, switching to play for Italy and not England. How would you sort of reflect on the last few weeks? Obviously, there's been a lot of attention.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a whirlwind, hasn't it? No, it's obviously sad to leave Quinns. It was an opportunity that was amazing with Benetton, and it's sad. Obviously, I've been there since I was 14, and it's where all my best mates are. But sometimes you've got to step out of your comfort zone and try something different, and hopefully it succeeds. And obviously, the Italy call up, I didn't really expect it. So, but no, I'm trying to try and stay, enjoy it at the moment, but also stay calm and do the best I can. And hopefully, that means I can continue being in these moments.
So, as Lynher said there, basically at halftime, they had a chat, realised that Scotland's defensive linemen, it can be quite weird, and they can leave a lot of space, mainly because they kind of have two sweepers out wide who will then cover in if there's anything in the middle. And so that led to that brilliant kind of Garbisi grubber, almost like side on, where he slotted it through, which gave Lynher the space to kind of cut through and beat a couple of men to score. I thought that adjustment was really interesting. Italy are just fun. I know we haven't said that much over the years. They're just exciting. I think in Menoncello and in Brex, they've probably got, I don't know, if you're thinking about form over the championship, probably the best centre pairing, maybe after Aki and Henshaw, in terms of how well they're playing.
Menoncello has been awesome.
He's so good.
Absolutely awesome.
So good. As is Brex.
Yeah, Brex is the ball player with those pullbacks, and they play a lot of those loop plays, don't they, with Garbisi kind of ghosting around. Manichello just thumps things. Both sides of the ball, thumps breakdowns, thumps carriers. He's just fantastic. There was one moment where he got cleared by a Scotland forward because he had a dabble with a jackal. And the Scotland forward sort of stood over him for a second. The Manichello rolled away, sort of looked back at him as though, I'm going to keep doing that all day. And he really did. He's a fantastic player. Just to go back on your point about how it's a young side, Colsey, Lamaro's captain at 25 years old, and he's a friend of the pod, of course. He's been on here previously. But then when in that interview, he spoke about how there had to be a patience around it because they were going to learn on the job because they were all young and you could basically just watch us. Did he lead from the front? Wow. 27 tackles.
I know.
And actually a big win for Italy under 20s over Scotland over the weekend as well, which is seriously exciting for their future.
His mentality.
What about Ross Vincent at number 8 as well?
Yes, your mate.
Is he friend of the pod? Or is he?
Yeah, I think so.
Contact of the pod. Has been spoken to. Yeah, he had a phenomenal break in the second half. I was just thinking about moments from Italy, which made me really encouraged. The scrum in the second half absolutely decimated Scotland. Like they fell apart. I loved talking about Menoncello. Yeah, his carrying was mad, but it came to nothing because Scotland scored through Carl Steyn. But he had an amazing tackle on Van der Merwe in the first half when basically it looked like Van der Merwe was certain to score, and Menoncello somehow got around his legs and pulled him down. And also the Brex try was just a really interesting kind of set play where Italy attacked off a maul, and it looked for all money as though Pajarello at scrum half was going to flick it back to Garbisi, and actually just put in a little grubber over the top for Brex to score, which I honestly don't think Scotland were expecting in any way, shape or form. It's quite rare to see a defence completely caught out by something like that, but he just found the space behind and it was such a clever attacking play that I was really impressed by what Italy had. I just think they've got so much potential with players in this team. And let's be honest, we'll chat about Wales in a sec, but I feel like they're favourites next week going to Cardiff. I mean, if they can recreate that kind of cohesion we saw on Saturday, why not?
I'd agree with that.
I'm just trying to think about what else. I think post-match interviews are quite interesting because sometimes you almost hear what you want to hear. But I thought Jamie George and Lamro had great ones on Saturday where Jamie George said, look, we were probably rightly written off after the Scotland game, but we finally shown what we're about kind of thing. And Lamro was equally good because he said the Wales win 2 years ago was kind of like a bolt from the blue. Nobody expected it. This win's more what we're about. Like we've had a couple of years to work on this. This is kind of our development. And I just thought, yeah, take me along for the ride. I'm on board.
Wales are 9-point favourites.
That's
mad, isn't it? But
what?
But in fairness, we did flag this last week, I think, that last year's fixture between the sides, it was set up to be, you know, Italy's chance. They beat them at home last year. Now they beat them away, sorry, last year. Now they've got them at home. And they laid an egg, didn't they? They were really bad.
Oh, yeah.
Reece Webb just cut them apart. This time does feel different, and it's going to be on Wales to rouse themselves.
And just finally on Scotland and on this game, Gregor Townsend was asked point blank after the game whether this result has any impact on his position as head coach and whether it's under threat.
Was that a punchy question? That feels like it's whoever's asked it there. There's got to be something building up that we're not seeing.
It wasn't me. I should clarify. But I guess it depends how harsh you are about where Scotland are.
Because in the World Cup, I suppose.
I almost have more sympathy for the World Cup because of the group they were in.
Yeah.
I think what people are annoyed about, I think people are genuinely frustrated that this is clearly a very talented team who should have beaten France before it came down to that final try, nearly blew it against Wales, and then blew it here in Rome. I think people are no longer just thinking that Scotland are plucky because they're not. They're too good for that.
I find that chat quite jarring, I guess, and I'm probably biased because I've covered most closely their games against England, where they look like a really balanced side with loads of options, punching above their weight, given their small player pool. And you just mentioned there guys who are coming in, Andy Christie, who's had a fantastic season for Saracens. I have to admit, wasn't entirely sure he'd be able to translate that to test matches, but he looks promising, really promising in that regard, and a really exciting player. And then they've got all those options, and then but But again, losing to Italy is really suboptimal.
Just one final moment about heads going. Dean Van der Merwe had a break at the end where I think George Horn was on his... No, Ali Price was on his inside. And Van der Merwe cut in and killed off the space for Price. And what seemed like a fairly decent 2-on-1 opportunity to score went. And that was the moment where I thought, you're not quite there mentally to win this game at that point. So that's where I think the frustration comes from. Townsend's not going anywhere. Let's be honest. I don't think, even though this is a disappointing end to the tournament. Charles, you're still in Wales. You're still the other side of the river. Tell us about yesterday. You said France didn't play that well, and yet they scored 45 points. So I'm intrigued.
They seemed very direct. They were very route one. They sort of reverted to type, and it was a bit of a get out of jail free selection by Gaultier. It felt really. It just felt, we'll just chuck all these monstrous blokes in and we'll go and bully Wales and overpower them, and they did. That is literally what happened. There wasn't much artistry or creativity to it. I think the outside backs were also very direct when they had some space. You know, they've got a stopgap fly half. Thomas Ramos is nominally a fullback playing 10, and it was, just had a bit of an armchair ride, really. He didn't seem to want to create much. He just lined up the big lads in midfield. One pass, up you truck it up, lads, and we'll try and play off you. I think Wales, when they stopped them at source, when they got off the line and when they chopped, were impressive. And that's when France struggled. It was when France got on the front foot, when they got that momentum, that they were virtually unstoppable. When Wales got off the line, Daffod Jenkins, I thought, was excellent. Tommy Raffel, I thought, was excellent. When they got off the line and when they stopped them at source, France looked a little bit out of sorts. The thing is, the reason why the scoreline flatters France in the end is that, in the end, Wales just couldn't stop them at source for 80 minutes. So France ran away with it in the last 15, 20 minutes. But until the hour mark, you know, Wales were winning at the hour mark. Because they were coping just about with France's physicality, but then France brought on basically their own bomb squad in Georges-Henri Colombe and Raymond Taufifanua and Sebastian Taufifanua and Malvaca, who's replacing Meafu and Antonio, and it was just all too much.
What's the French for bomb squad?
I have absolutely no idea.
Squad. Oh, come on. Come on.
There won't be a good translation.
You've been like a kid at Christmas waiting for Miafu's debut. Did it live up to the hype? He had a lovely, lovely little pullback pass for that Gael Fiki try, didn't he?
Yeah, he was good. Obviously, he's been injured, so he was substituted early on. And just chatting to him afterwards, he's just a really lovely bloke, given that he came out of nowhere, given this lifeline by Toulouse, and now he's unbelievable. I'm playing Test rugby for France. He was good. He was obviously well-marked by Wales, but in the end, that ended up benefiting France because he'd take out three Welsh defenders when he carried. They were getting up and they were chopping him, and they were aware that he was a big bloke. And so he wasn't necessarily making a sort of really tangible impact in terms of yardage. But what he was doing is he was sucking in Wales's entire back row, and then there was space elsewhere. France struggled to exploit that space elsewhere. There were three forward passes, I think. And some of the attack was a little bit clunky. I think the midfield, I think Gael Fiku is not playing the best rugby of his life, I don't think. Deporter at 12 looked promising. Barre at 15 looked promising. And BLBRA and Penno are obviously just absolutely lethal and lightning. And obviously, we have to talk about friend of the pod, Nolan Le Garec, who replaced Maxime Luku, got man of the match, and deservedly so. You know, he was really lively at the base, and he deserved man of the match just for that pass, really.
I was going to say, is the real winner from Sunday actually me for backing Le Garec to the high heavens to be good in this Six Nations and actually getting a Player of the Match award out of him? I feel vindicated, Charlie. I feel vindicated.
My breakthrough player was Joe McCarthy. He was
started
quite,
hot.
It's quite quiet, to be fair.
Started
on,
hot
on Saturday
in the tournament. And, yeah.
I think mine was Meafu. I think. So that's also slightly backfired in that he's been injured for the first three games, but hopefully he has a stormer against England.
We're there overall. I thought France looked like maybe England did a little bit at Murrayfield with those backline changes. Those backline changes, when you sort of surrender that cohesion, that it just does. It's really boring. I think it's really boring for coaches to sort of go up on a pedestal in press conference and go, guys, have some patience with these changes because they will come good eventually. And we need to blood these players, but it might look stodgy for a bit. It's boring to say and it's boring to write about, but it's just a reality. And I think that's where France were with the forward passes, with some of the defensive lapses in the first sort of three quarters of that game. But yeah, the power and what they have there is pretty formidable. And just Wales, as game as they were, just couldn't live with it, it seemed.
I was surprised at the lack of ambition, though. I was surprised at the lack of ambition. That came later on when the game was gone. But certainly in the first half, bar the Le Garrick, magnificent pass, there did seem to be a real lack of ambition from France. It was just a sort of, we'll send the big boys up and then we'll keep sending the big boys up. And if that doesn't work, we'll send the big boys up.
You've touched on Wales being shockingly large favourites to win against Italy. I think I wrote before the start of the tournament that two wins in this tournament for Wales would be great. And actually, there was a point yesterday where I thought, well, France have been a bit off in this tournament. Maybe today's the day. And then it all fell apart drastically. The power issue is really concerning. The scrum issue is really concerning. That's flared up at times in pretty much every game this week. And to tee up our chat with Lewis Rees-Sammet in a little bit, when I spoke to him, he mentioned that Wales, during kind of patches in their games in this tournament, have been really good. They're just trying to get it together for 80 minutes. It's hard at the moment for Wales, isn't it? It's hard because we talk about the regional struggles and the issues there and the player pathway coming through and there's so many young players in this side who are kind of learning on the job. I'm struggling for optimism, Charlie.
Bonus points get them off the bottom if they beat.
Oh well,
if they beat Italy by the margin the bookies reckon they will. And I think you look at the individuals for the crumbs of optimism, don't you? So Wainwright, Raffle, Winnett, they've still got some itch. I think Thomas Williams needs to become a more and more important player for that side because he's just a spark plug. He's so kind of lively and get a lot of things going through him. But you're just looking at quite important positions, 10, that centre combination that entire midfield that just needs solidifying over the course, if they are going to progress over the course of this World Cup cycle.
I've got a question for the two of you.
Oh no, go on.
A good mate of mine, who I'm going to have to give a shout out to, John, had an accumulator.
Ooh. You told me about this.
On Italy,
yeah,
England, and Wales to all win.
Did he cash out?
Punchy.
£10 would have got him £790. And on Saturday night, he was offered cash out at £200. Would you have cashed out?
I fancied Wales by a score.
My mates and I have a strict rule about cashing out results in punishments, so I wouldn't have done it for that reason.
Well, I got on the high horse because I told him to cash out.
Oh, well, there you go.
What did he do?
He didn't, and he lost it.
Oh, desperate.
Live by the sword, die by the sword. John, well done, mate.
Gamble responsibly. Right, I had a quick chat yesterday with Lewis Rees-Sammet from the US, where he's getting closer and closer to the crucial stage in his international player pathway scheme, where he impresses in front of scouts. So let's hear how he's getting on. How are you getting on? How many weeks into the programme are you now?
Oh, seven or 8 weeks, I think. Now it's really good, really good, really enjoying it. It's kind of flown by, to be honest with you. Like, there's not long left now, so it's been a great experience.
I think I watched the latest episode of the IPP series today, and I think someone said at one point this is like the dog days of your hard work, especially in the gym. Can you talk to me about what you've been doing, and I guess how much you might have changed physically since you went into the program compared to rugby?
Yeah, so we got Kevin, who heads our S&C here, and he's been putting us through workouts pretty hard since week one. So I think everyone's getting a lot stronger, a lot physically stronger, and he's definitely putting us through some tough workouts, and especially, as you say, like the dog days now. This is when it matters, week 7, week 8. when your body's tired and you've got to try and push through it. So, yeah, it's great. We've only got a couple of weeks left, but, you know, we're all head down focused.
Have you packed on more muscle? Are you leaner? How has it sort of changed since you've started the program?
To be honest with you, I've stayed pretty similar. I don't want to get too heavy and get slower or vice versa. But I think I'm at a perfect weight to be able to run fast and change direction pretty quick. So, you know, I'm pretty happy with my weight and stuff like that. So,
you've got the pro day coming up in a few weeks. Did you watch a lot of the combine in Indianapolis just to get an idea of what's coming up?
Yeah, for sure. We all watched it over that weekend, and you know, there's some exciting players in that combine. But you know, we're fully focused on ourselves. There's 10 of us here that are fully focused on the job ahead, and you know, we've all improved massively since week one, and you know, we got 2 weeks now to put our heads down and really focus.
At this stage of the program, are you more? I know you're doing a lot of stuff in the gym. Is it still a lot of classroom time, kind of learning things about routes and things like that?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you can't not learn football or stop learning football. You know, everyone's learning football, no matter how old you are. So, you know, since week one, we've been in the classroom, you know, figuring everything out and learning everything we need to do. And that'll continue for the next 2 weeks. And, you know, we need to get smarter. But I think the difference between week one and now is massive. I think everyone's getting a real good idea of the game. And, you know, we're all pretty excited to go out there and show everyone what we can do.
Is that almost the hardest part of this process, kind of taking on board all that information in such a short space of time? Because obviously you have the physical abilities are there, but actually learning all those parts of the game, is that what seems to be the trickiest bit?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we're all pretty much leaving our previous sports to learn a complete new game. So, you know, that in itself is tough enough. But I think the difference, if you were to come in week one and come in now, you'd see an incredible difference between everyone's knowledge. So, you know, we just got to continue to work hard in the classroom and obviously on the field and the gym, and just put ourselves in the best opportunity to go out there and show the scouts what we can do.
With the combine, the 40-yard dash always kind of steals the headlines with that, and I know a record was set a couple of weeks ago. Have you got an idea what your time might be? Have you got anything in mind yet, or are you still working that out?
I'm still working it out. To be honest, we do a lot of speed sessions here. Just before training, we do a lot of speed sessions. So, you know, there's still a few things I want to tweak and change up, and Steph's going to make me faster. But I'm really excited to see what time I get on the 20th of March, and hopefully, you know, I run really quick.
Talk to me about the NFL for you and kind of how this all started. So did your dad played when you were growing up? Is that it? And what kind of teams and players did you watch as well?
Yeah, so my dad played as a teenager back in the UK. It was quite tough back then to you know, unless you had money and you were able to fly out to America and go to college, etc. It was really tough, and he wasn't able to do that. So, you know, to kind of continue his legacy and kind of, you know, allow him to say like his son is in the NFL would be a dream come true for me. Not just that, I think being a two sport athlete is pretty special. You know, there's not many of them out there, and to do that would be pretty amazing for myself. But I just want to inspire people to back home to know that there is a pathway to be in the NFL. And you know, as I'm here, the international player pathway has been unbelievable. And, you know, this pathway is something that anyone from the UK can get to and get to the NFL. So it's just about working hard now I'm here and trying to get that opportunity.
Has it been nice having Harry Mallander around as well? Just a kind of familiar face.
Yeah. to be honest, I don't think, like, we obviously knew of each other, but I think we played against each other, but we never really met each other. But, you know, it was pretty easy for us to get on. You know, obviously he's English, which isn't great for me, but no, he's a great lad. And, you know, I'm sure he's going to go on to do great things.
We're talking not long before Wales
kickoff against France. I just wondered how much of the Six Nations have you been able to watch, and have you been sort of watching it down on your own, like with friends, or how's it worked?
I've been able to watch all the Wales games. The timings are pretty hard because it's early in the morning here, like pretty much every game, and I got training, so I've been able to catch it when I can, and I've been keeping up to date with it. And obviously, I've seen the shock result of England yesterday, but good on them. I mean, they've everyone slammed them and ruled them out, and to go and beat Ireland's pretty special. So fair play to them. But nice, that just makes it a really interesting competition now, because obviously Italy beat Scotland yesterday, and you know Italy could have beaten France last week. So you know, this, I think everyone's getting really more competitive, and the Six Nations is this year especially is definitely, you know, bright.
And when you're watching, is like the rugby part of your brain still kind of whirring away thinking about stuff, or is that slowed down a bit?
I mean, like when I watch Wales play, I'm still like, oh, like it feels like I'm still on the pitch. You know, I'll always support Wales, and you know, I'm going to be watching them today. So, I'm still obviously massively into rugby and keeping updated on it. But I know the job at hand I've got here, and I'm fully focused on it.
I had a chat with George Skivington not long after your move was announced, and he said that you spoke with him after the game against Edinburgh for Gloucester, and basically said, look, in my mind, that's kind of my last game of rugby. I guess is that just like the strong mindset that you have to have in order to make this a success, really?
Yeah, you can't have any doubts going into this. I mean, it's one of the toughest leagues in the world to get into, so if you have any sort of doubt in your head, you're never going to make it. So, you know, I'm fully confident in my ability, and you know, we got great coaches here to really lead us on to make it in the NFL. And ultimately, it's up to us to learn on the field, learn in the classroom, and then just have that opportunity to perform in front of scouts.
And I saw some quotes where how much of a different world is it essentially going from rugby to this? Do you sort of feel? I think I saw some quotes where you said you feel like you can sort of express yourself more in the NFL, like celebrations are more encouraged and things like that. Just talk to me about that and why you feel that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, pretty much every sport in America is massive to them. You know, people watching the Super Bowl, the viewers they get, just how everyone's so excited about it. It's just something I want to be a part of, to be honest with you. And I thought, you know, what better league to be in than the NFL? The fans in America are amazing, and you know, they really cheer their teams on. So, you know, it'd be a dream come true to make it.
And were you feeling that in rugby, that you sort of couldn't? I know you got a stick for one of the celebrations at the World Cup. Was that kind of, I don't know, talk to me about that. Was that quite annoying? Or
I mean, like, it was obviously annoying because people thought I was being disrespectful, but I was just celebrating. Like, every sport, pretty much every sport, apart from rugby, celebrates when they score. So, you know, I did that, and then, you know, I was getting slammed for it. So it wasn't great, but at the same time, I knew I wasn't being disrespectful. I was just enjoying the game, enjoying the atmosphere, enjoying being at the World Cup. Like, it's absolutely massive to be at a Rugby World Cup, so... in my head, I was just enjoying it, and but then all of a sudden you get slammed. But it is what it is, and you know, I fancy a change, and I really want to go for this now.
Have you had a chance to chat to Christian Wade much about his experience? He obviously did pretty well when he went over there and was there for quite a while with the Bills. Has he given you any advice?
Yeah, we've had a few messages on Instagram and stuff. So he's given me a fair bit of advice. I managed to see a few posts from when I asked him how it was in like 2020, when he was first, you know, making it out there in the Buffalo Bills, and when he scored that mad touchdown. So yeah, he's given me a lot of advice, and you know, I'm taking it on board. Ultimately, I've got 1.5 weeks now to fully focus and get in the best shape as possible to perform.
And are you still thinking that you'll try and play a bit of receiver and a bit of running back? You're still kind of working that out, or are you likely to be more of a receiver, do you think?
No, I don't want to pigeonhole myself to be one certain position. I think I can play multiple positions on the pitch, and that's what I'm learning. You know, I'm trying to learn a lot of roles to be able to have the ability to, when I do get an opportunity, to know what I'm doing and be fully focused on that. And I think that's great. It's great here because all the coaches, you know, they pretty much know everything. So, you know, it's great having them on hand to be able to teach me. And because a lot of it is in the classroom, being able to learn different roles and different different offenses, learn the defenses. But yeah, it's been great, and you know, I'm absolutely loving it. Yeah.
Just to go back to Wales, I mean, they might have a win in a couple of hours, which would be great. But it's obviously been an interesting tournament in terms of developing kind of young talent. I wonder what you've made of someone like Cam Winnett when you've been watching at fullback, who's kind of come in, not a lot of professional games, but has been brilliant. How impressed have you been by the likes of him and Rio Dyer as well in that back three?
I mean, there's been a lot of youngsters brought into that squad for the Six Nation. I think Johan Lloyd's played amazing as well. Sam's been great. Cam Winnett's been unbelievable for just being thrown into, you know, his first campaign. He started his first game. So, you know, I'm very proud of those boys and what they've done. I think, you know, it is a young squad and it's going to take time to build the chemistry. But I think they've done really well so far. I think they've been able to put in good performances at certain times in the game. It's just about being able to do it for 80 minutes. And, you know, I have no doubt that, you know, the more games they play, the more chemistry they get, they're going to get better and better.
Have you had much contact with Warren since your decision or not so much?
No, not so much. I think he's got enough on his plate at the minute, being at the Six Nations. So, but I did have great chats with him before, and you know, I massively appreciate that from him.
Just the last one I have for you was obviously, like you say, it has actually flown by that you're seven or 8 weeks into this. I just wanted to hear from you just about your kind of confidence about the process and how mm-hmm. much you're enjoying it and how good you feel about the decision and how everything's going.
I mean, I think, you know, I've looked back at footage from week one to now, and I think I've changed massively. I think, you know, I've got a real learning of the game and a good understanding, and you can just tell on the field the difference that the coaches have made for me, and they've been able to help me massively. You know, I can't put into words how much they've helped me, and you know, we've had a few coaches out here that have been able to change my game a bit and teach me how to run routes, teach me how to play running back. We've done a lot of special teams out here, so you know, I'm so excited to see what the future holds, and we'll see in the next few weeks how it all ends up being. But you know, I'm fully focused for the next 1.5 weeks until Pro Day on the 20th of March, and I can't wait to see what the future holds.
Best of luck with it. Great to speak to you.
Okay, thank you.
That was Lewis Rees-Emmett telling us about how he's been up in the early hours watching the Six Nations and you know, trying to just focus on the NFL.
Colsey, having spoken to him, your feeling, does he make it?
Oh, Charlie, that's such a hard question. Listen, physically, he has as much ability as anyone could ever ask for to be in this position and to try and make it. So that there's nothing, I don't think there's any reason there why he couldn't do it. But you're just on, the program sounds amazing in terms of how the players are kind of handled and how they're taught the game. I think it's incredible. You're just on such a crazy crash course of like trying to learn everything about the sport, especially in his position. You have to learn so much about play calls, about which routes to run, about blocking a bit, about just how to get clear, basically. And also then you're going to be doing it against the best athletes in the world, which is a long-winded way of me saying, I think he's got as good a chance as anybody. I'm fascinated to see how his pro day goes. I think realistically, the dream for him is get signed to a practice squad, which is kind of like a reserve squad. Have a season on that squad where you're kind of training some days with the main 53-man roster. I mean, first he has to get on a 90-man roster. Then when it gets down to the core 53, if he can do that, have a year on the practice squad, try and impress. Sure. Like I don't see it's impossible. I've spoken with Christian Wade about this before as well, about his time for the Bills. He was kind of waiting for a chance with the Bills. He was always on the practice squad, had an amazing kick or punt return touchdown in preseason. Everybody was like, whoa, who's this guy? And it didn't quite work out. But Rees-Emmett's so young at 23.
Maybe. Yeah. What do you think?
I'd love him to, because I think all the commentary around it has been how hard it is to do. And I love how forthright he is, how clearly confident he is in his own athletic ability, but also his ability to take on all this information. And I just think it'd put rugby in the spotlight as well. As much as it might kind of be a carrot for other rugby players to leave, I think, to show that the sport has those kind of athletes itself would be really cool.
Let's get into some of your questions. We've cherry-picked the best ones. So well done if you've made the cut. Starting with Will, who says, it's fascinating how Beefy Power dominated in 2019 England were under Jones when they had the Vunipola brothers and Manu, and that was like their core. But their current focal points are pace and all about targeting the shoulders, so Earl, Lawrence and Furbank. Charlie, that's an interesting point, isn't it? It's a different dynamic in this side.
Beefy Power, yeah. So like Borthwick has been... Borthwick has been quite open, without saying it totally explicitly, that England are going to have to move on from... They're a different side with different assets than they were when Manu Tuilagi, when the Vunipola brothers were in their prime. Now, I wouldn't say... He's sort of had to offset that by bringing in Ethan Roots at six when it was apparent that George Martin wasn't going to be fit for those first couple of Six Nations games. So they have got power elsewhere. It means that Ellis Genge is a go-to carrier in the tight, whereas Billy Vunipola would have been taking on a lot of that work. It means that they're trying to, as Will kind of implies there, they're trying to get Ollie Lawrence running at shoulders. You're trying to get Ben Earl. And as we mentioned earlier, I think Ben Earl has benefited from having those, the sort of the hybrid forward in Chesham, who I thought was fantastic against Ireland. That's maybe given him a little bit more room. I thought Jamie George stepped up as a carrier. I think Sam Underhill has quietly stepped up as a carrier this tournament, not necessarily making massively eye catching breaks, but just denting defenses enough to generate quick ruck. So it's kind of been, and that has been part of this, again, Steve Borthwick hasn't explicitly sort of implored supporters to give him patience, but I think it's just been part of his understanding that these things are going to be gradual, because it's a move away from it. And it's really interesting, because I think it's how he sees the profile of players coming through. I don't think there are players like Billy Manu and Mako knocking around that they can add. Maybe someone like Alfie Barbary and Tom Willis as eight options give them something different. I mean, Chandler Cunningham South, just to go back a little bit, he was a guy who was fast-tracked because England didn't necessarily have that dynamism and that power. So, yeah, I certainly think it's moving away a little bit. And I think now, whereas they've been able to bully teams with a sort of round the corner, sort of power game and phase play, I think now kick return has to be a really big weapon for them.
Just to add to that, I think it has sort of come out of necessity, hasn't it? I think that in an ideal world, they would still have a barnstorming carrying number eight, but it just doesn't necessarily exist. Maybe Alpha Barbary, as you said, Charlie, we think that he was going to be in the squad pre-tournament had he not been banned. And there's nothing to say he would have started. I mean, Ben Earl is playing phenomenally well, but he is still really an open side, isn't he? I can't see him moving to eight for Saracens. So he could still play as he is now, an open side for England with a slightly more heavy duty ball carrying number eight.
We always talk about Ardy Surveyor in relation to Ben Earl, and I think what the All Blacks are lucky that they've had Shannon Frizzell. I think you're right, Charles. I think with Tom Willis there, we won't see Ben Earl wearing eight, but he can still rock out there for offensive scrums, and that's how they'll have that variety.
You mentioning Cunningham South actually leads into our next question from Titch, who says, with France turning on the power in the second half against Wales, how does that kind of affect England's bench, given that Cunningham South isn't going to be there? So, yeah, what are they going to do? Who do you reckon they will draft in Cunningham South's place? Charles?
Probably Alex Coles will come back in alongside Dom Brandt. I can't see many changes given how well they went at the weekend. Guy Pepper has obviously been called into the squad, the wider training squad, but it would be a really sort of bold call to promote him immediately to the matchday squad.
Having watched both games on the weekend and seen both benches, have France got an obvious edge there, do you think?
Definitely. And there were shades of the World Cup semi-final where England are going to have to be so strong at set piece for 80 minutes against this French team, which they obviously they weren't against South Africa in the World Cup quite spectacularly. So I don't know. Is this a start Marler and Cole sort of approach again? I mean, but then do you lose too much at scrum time if you're bringing Genge and Stewart on at 65 minutes? I'm not sure, but England are certainly going to have to be watertight there.
Theory, based on zero intel, they could go 6-2 given Marcus Smith's ability to cover 15. And they could add Coles to the bench that they had on Saturday, maybe with Pearson instead of Chandler Cunningham South, and then keeping Don Brandt there. Don Brandt was a really interesting selection, I think, and that was tied to the kick return opportunities that they thought they were going to get. And Chandler Cunningham South had one really sort of old school, I think it was from a 22 dropout, where he just got the ball sort of left and right and went, tilted the lance and gave it a go, because that was just such an important avenue for England. So I agree. I think 6-2 always comes into your thinking against France. So that would be very interesting.
Not to pour cold water on that, but Pearson isn't actually in the squad.
Yeah, he's not. Well, there you go.
Is Ben Curry still there, or has he dropped
ben
out?
Ben Curry's not there either. You could go.
He was injured, wasn't he, Ben Curry?
Maybe. So just looking at it, maybe it'll be Coles, Roots, and Don Brandt.
Wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
Which is lumps. Big old lumps.
Sorry, Tom Pearson.
Yeah, me too. I'm sorry,
Tom. Rub it in.
I'm sorry. You should be in. Giles asks, how many games can you cite where it was the sixth bench forward who made a difference to the result? I assume here he's talking about...
I'll tell you. The World Cup
Why
final.
Why did teams go 6-2? Yeah.
Quagga Smith in the World Cup final.
That was so sassy.
He was pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, Ryan Baird wasn't the sixth bench forward the other week against Wales for Ireland, but he was pretty unbelievable. Yeah. He was wearing number 20.
Quagga Smith and the familiarity that Felix Jones has with him, wind him up, watch him go, watch him absolutely wreck breakdowns. He was arguably the difference in that World Cup final as New Zealand came on.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I don't think we need to top that anymore. And our last question, which many of you said, presumably from the Leicester area, is there a way Freddie Stewart can be accommodated in this system moving forward? Yeah, I'm sure there is, Charles, but there's been clearly an uptick in how England have attacked, even though it's two games with George Furbank at fullback. So how does it happen?
I'm not sure, in all honesty. I think that Furbank has got the shirt. I think, as Charlie has written, certainly two of those three England tries, they probably don't score with Freddie Stewart at 15. Freddie Stewart's super strength is obviously his aerial ability. And against teams that like to kick high and follow up, he'll be more valuable to that England side. But Furbank has the shirt, and he has looked a class apart, ball in hand. I mean, he's been playing so well for Northampton, and he offers something much different in the 15 shirt to Freddie Stewart. And if England are looking at going down this route of a more ball playing fullback, then that is not Freddie Stewart at the minute. And I know I was chatting to a Guillaume Dufy, friend of the pod, of L'Équipe last week, the French sports newspaper, and that was what he was asking as well. He was like, I can't believe that Freddie Stewart has been dropped. He's one of the best fullbacks in the world. And my response was just quite simply, yes, but what the skills that George Furbank has and is bringing to this England team is what this
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
England team is lacking. Whereas what Freddie Stewart brings is, you know, incredible high ball technical abilities. But if teams aren't going to kick in that manner, then you would have Furbank in, wouldn't you?
If I'm honest, sorry, Charlie, I got you.
No, I was just going to say the one caveat to that is that would be a way that England will get contestable kicks. I imagine will be a way that England tried to get into the game against France, because they've not looked entirely convincing over the course of this championship in that area. And there's I did also just go back and check the bench for the World Cup final, and Quagga Smith was the sixth bench forward, but they also obviously had a seventh bench
well,
forward. But it counts.
You technically answered it. I was purely going to add that I never thought we would have this conversation about Stewart, just because I thought England would be so loyal to him that they would find a way to sort of operate around him and compensate for those kind of things that he lacks, because they liked his high ball ability so much. So actually, in a way, it's almost a credit to England that they have moved off him.
Well, I think the way you move, I certainly think he adds to the 33 caps he's got at the minute, but I think what that might take now is either a different midfield, which you don't really want to do now that that's one settling, or just more prominence from Slade as a distributor, which actually we saw against Ireland a little bit.
Right, that's it for today. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Charles. And a big thanks to Lewis Rees-Sammet as well for his time. Hope everything goes well on the pro day. Thank you, everybody, for downloading the podcast. There's one more round of games in the Six Nations to come. There's wall-to-wall coverage over on the Telegraph website throughout the week. Oh, where are you going to be, by the way? Sorry. Charles, where are you going to be?
Leon for Le Crunch.
Charlie, where are you going
to
be?
Cutting around Pennyhill Park again for the first half of the week and then off to Leon on Friday.
Okay, and I'm going to be in Dublin, where I assume Ireland are going to win the Six Nations title.
I'd have thought so.
Let's say not, just to build up the tension. But the three of us will be back next week to review the final round of the Six Nations. It's going to be the final episode of the series as well. Save your tears. We've had a lovely time. We'll chat to you next week. Goodbye.